Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's special edition of Your Call's Media Roundtable, we are spending the hour with media scholar and author Robert McChesney. Back in May, Robert told Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman that mainstream media coverage of the election hit an all-time low. Well, right after the election, journalists, cable show hosts, and pundits said they needed to do some soul searching, some very deep soul searching, because they said they were blindsided by Donald Trump's Electoral College victory. So what has really changed? What have they learned? It has been almost 3 weeks since Election Day. What changes have you seen or heard in the media? There have been many complaints of media outlets from CNN to NPR normalizing hate speech from white supremacists. So how should the media cover this faction of Trump supporters? And also, what about the economics of the media? The Washington Post had a piece recently called $1 Billion Profit. Yes, the campaign has been a gusher for CNN. According to the Washington Post, CNN's profits will hit $1 billion this year. This is a milestone unseen in its 36-year history. Over at Fox, they're projected to hit $1.67 billion. Today, we're joined by Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and the author of several books, including his most recent, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, co-authored with the nation's John Nichols. Robert is also co-founder of the media reform organization Free Press. Hi, Robert. Welcome back to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. I've been on vacation for the last 2 weeks, just back on the air today, and try to kind of disconnect, but for obvious reasons, it was almost impossible. It's been almost 3 weeks since Donald Trump won the election, the Electoral College. Right now, Hillary Clinton's popular vote is about over 2 million. But there's been so many articles about the role of the media in this election and how so many people did not predict that Donald Trump would win. How are you analyzing this? How complicit do you think the media are in Donald Trump's rise and his victory?
Well, there's no doubt that they were central to his rise. I mean, it was the lavish, unprecedented, extraordinary amount of media coverage that the news media gave Donald Trump in the second half of 2015, beginning when he was just a joke candidate and considered to sort of an object of ridicule on some networks, but nonetheless they gave him massive attention compared to other candidates that vaulted him into prominence and gave him the platform upon which he could generate a following. And then once he starts doing well in the polls, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy and they've got to cover him as a legitimate candidate. So, I mean, it's impossible to explain the Donald Trump phenomenon without seeing it first and foremost as a media phenomenon. Had Donald Trump been covered as someone who had no business running for president, who really had no public record and nothing to stand on, was just sort of a buffoon and treated by the news media like that, he would have gotten almost no coverage. He would have gotten like a Pat Paulson's coverage in 1968 when he was a comedian who ran for president.
How much time do you think we in the independent media should spend looking back at that and constantly reminding ourselves and listeners and readers what we were subjected to in 2015?
I think it's,
or 2016, sorry.
Deal with that and keep it front and foremost. I think there's one of the problems with having a bad media system is that we reinforce the amnesia about what just happened in American politics, and it gets sort of thrown down the memory hole and forgotten. And there are important lessons there that need to be remembered constantly. And that's just one of the many of this past election cycle.
Where are you looking for a good analysis of what happened? Thomas Frank wrote a long piece in the recent edition of Harper's called SWAT Team, The Media's Extermination of Bernie Sanders and Real Reform. And he just eviscerated the Washington Post. I mean, they wrote op-ed after op-ed just slamming Bernie Sanders. And he also went into some detail about the sort of pundit class and these op-ed writers who in some cases now have more power than reporters.
Well, and I haven't read Tom's piece yet. I've read his recent book, Listen Liberal, which is also really mandatory reading to understand American politics and the Democratic Party. But I did consult with Tom while I was working on the piece, and I do believe that every bit as much as the media was central to the rise and prominence of Donald Trump, it was also similarly central to the destruction of Bernie Sanders and making Hillary Clinton the nominee of the Democratic Party. I'm sure Tom's piece hits it well, but the WikiLeaks revelations that came out in the summer about the collaboration of the Democratic National Committee with the Clinton campaign also demonstrated, shockingly, the complicity of the major news media with both the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign to make sure she got the nomination. It was quite stunning.
Right. And as you said, we often move on so quickly and forget what happened just last week. How important do you think it is for us to really look back and take a look at those emails and what they revealed about what goes on behind closed doors?
Well, it's really central at a number of different levels. For one thing, the great meme now that Paul Ryan is spreading and that the mainstream media and Fox News are spreading, is too much the mainstream media, is that this is the nation has turned to the right and that they want a whole new set of policies like privatizing public education, Social Security, Medicare, and lowering taxes yet again on billionaires, as if that's something the American people are clamoring for. When in fact, I think when you look at the media role, the media is a central role in actually repressing the fact that this country is moving dramatically to the left. Mm-hmm. That's really the lesson if you just look at public sentiment of the past year. I mean, that was the stunning lesson of the Sanders campaign. And I think if you look at the vote turnout around the country, even in the general election, it's almost impossible to see this country is turning dramatically to the right. In fact, a significant percentage of Trump voters in exit polls, I think it was 23%, said they wanted to see the country take a more liberal course. 23% of people voting for Trump. So when you add all that together, we have to say how come it is that in a country that where the country, you know, looking at the Sanders campaign, looking at the support he received, looking at the polling data, is not a right-wing country. How do we end up with the most right-wing, kooky presidency in memory?
Also, it's important to note that over 90 million eligible voters did not vote. And so almost, what, half of eligible voters didn't vote, and yet we don't really hear much about those people. There are very few stories about people who don't vote.
It's even worse than that, is that because, you know, the United States, of all the countries in the world that hold democratic elections, that hold elections for public office, you know, our election systems, I mean, if not the worst in the world, it's awfully close to the bottom. And our news media appear to be invested in spreading the idea that we're the world's greatest democracy and never really pursuing the great weaknesses of that argument. So we get some discussion of it when it's forced, but otherwise it completely goes down the memory hole. Voter turnout's a classic case in point. Our voting turnout is well below that of any other credible democracy in the world. If some country that we're routinely trashing, like Venezuela, had a voter turnout rate like the United States, we'd probably consider it a fraud. You know, we barely over half of the voting age population votes. It's always been bad. Now, it periodically picks up. In 2008, I think it went up to 57 or 58% of the voting age population. The enthusiasm for Obama drove that. But we've really been just around half of the voting population voting for the last 30 or 40 years, slightly over half. And, you know, that even doesn't even begin to cover the depravity of what is considered our democratic system. I mean, you mentioned before something that sort of gets glossed over, the absurdity of our electoral college. And I think it's almost incredible journalists would harp on that point. Mm. I mean, would simply, every time they talk about this election, they would just mention in the second paragraph it's based on an absurd system, the electoral college, which was put together in the Constitution to protect slave owners so they could dominate elections without letting slaves vote. You know, that's why we have the Electoral College. It was put in place as opposed to having one person, one vote to elect the president, because the slave owners in Virginia and the South wanted to get credit for having larger populations in their states, i.e. having black slaves, but didn't want to let them vote. So they cut a deal with the North saying each slave is worth 3/5 of a person for Electoral College purposes. That's why we have the Electoral College. And, you know, that's such an outrageous situation. It's so, and, you know, that should be, every American should know that and live with that and understand how preposterous that is. Yet it's largely unknown in America.
a lot of people get sort of crash courses when something like this happens, when the Democrat, for example, receives more votes than the Republican, but the Republican wins the Electoral College. And the headline today is that Green Party candidate Jill Stein has raised almost $5 million in the past couple of days for an election recount in three states won by Trump, including Pennsylvania, Michigan, and then Wisconsin. What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I think it's great that she did that, and more power to Jill Stein. I think it's, you know, what the subhead today ought to be is, where the heck is the Democratic Party on something like this? Where the heck is Hillary Clinton? Why are they basically rolling over and going back to sleep on something like this and leaving it to the Green Party? Because the reason why Jill Stein is doing this is that in these states, the only person who's allowed to challenge for recount has to be someone who's on the ballot. Mm. So if Jill Stein didn't do it, it would have to either be Hillary Clinton or Gary Johnson in those three states in all likelihood. And she's the only one that stepped up to the plate. You know, the votes were very close in all three states. It's arguable that it'll show that Donald Trump will have won. But I think what we learned in Florida in 2000 is that when you do recounts, you find actually there can be a lot of mistakes made. That there are, you know, problems with these electoral systems. I think that getting a recount in all three of these states is absolutely the right thing to do, and we should thank Jill Stein and the people who gave money to do this for their efforts here.
And according to NBC News, Hillary Clinton's campaign officials haven't commented on this. A few people off the record said they were concerned that the issue would disrupt the transfer of power or cause even further unrest over Donald Trump's win.
Well, you know, I think that comment and the whole Hillary Clinton response to this, similar to the Al Gore response in 2000 in Florida in that election, you know, that probably says the Democratic Party has no business being, you know, that's a good advertisement for the end of the Democratic Party. Or it's, you know, because you're looking at the Republican Party in a similar situation, always has plans to take power. You know, they're serious about taking power and putting their agenda in place. So before the 2000 election and before the 2016 election, the Republicans were looking at a situation where they might lose the Electoral College but win the popular vote, and had plans put in place to battle that, to force the Electoral College electors to vote for them because they won the popular vote. Then when it turns the other way and they're the lucky recipients of the Electoral College, then suddenly it's the word of God is spoken. It can't be challenged. Why the Democrats play along with this is beside me, and I think it drives a lot of people apoplectic. And it's hard to take the Democrats seriously when you see the Republicans, you know, basically fighting for what they can get, and the Democrats rolling over to be Mr. Nice Guy and be stepped on the face.
Today we're speaking with Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and author of several books, including his most recent, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. He co-authored this with John Nichols, a reporter with The Nation. We had John on earlier this year about this book, and we'll ask Robert a couple questions about it, because it is closely connected with media coverage or lack of coverage about some of these really important issues surrounding jobs. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. After the election, journalists, pundits, the cable show hosts said they clearly needed to do some soul searching because they were blindsided by Donald Trump's Electoral College victory. So what has really changed? Are you seeing many changes in what you're reading and hearing? What have they learned? And then we're going to be talking about this over the next year. How should the media cover Donald Trump, especially the white supremacist faction of his supporters? There have been a lot of complaints about media outlets from NPR to CNN normalizing hate speech from white supremacists. So what are your thoughts about that? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Bob, you wanted to jump in?
Well, boy, those are such great questions. Yeah, and I know that probably your listeners are chomping at the bit to jump in as well. You know, I think one of the great weaknesses of professional journalism is, as it's devolved in the United States, is that if someone gains power, they're taken as legitimate, regardless of their position. So, you know, theoretically, if a Nazi party were to be elected to political office, professional journalists in this country would theoretically take them seriously and treat them with the same respect they would treat any other political movement. And this, of course, leads to real problems. I mean, it leads to ethical questions journalists have to ask and really propose how they're going to deal with when you're dealing with explicitly racist and white supremacist, anti-Semitic, and all sorts of hate groups that are winning elections and gaining power. And, you know, what we're having now is we've crossed the line. It was one thing, Rose, you know, back before this election for the last, I'd say generation or two, because, you know, it wasn't too long ago that hate groups were treated very respectfully in this country, especially in the U.S. South until the 1960s. But, you know, but now we're at a point where when these white supremacists are not David Duke, they're not like the guy who's been neo-Nazi Klansman, who's sort of an embarrassment to the Republican Party and everyone has to run for cover when his name is mentioned. Now they're sort of getting rehabilitated and they're getting brought back into legitimacy with this alt-right white racist movement. And it's sort of, you know, it was always the seamy underside of the Republican Party since the 1960s, following the Goldwater years, that they were playing to the white racist vote, but they never would say and admit it. They would never embrace it publicly. It was just something they lived with. Now, with the Trump campaign, there's more of an open embrace, and it sort of puts the Republican Party in a dilemma because they love power and they want to use power to exercise it, unlike apparently the Democratic Party. And they, you know, so they're going to make their deals with the devil, and so they're doing that right now. Well, journalists now suddenly are, what do you do? Because you're, on one hand, they're told they've got to cover the Republicans fairly, and this is who the Republicans are, because they're one of the two main parties that we're supposed to treat a certain way. But they're also embracing stuff now that, you know, has been, until now, for generations, rejected out of hand as, you know, wrong because it's racist, and racism is fundamentally wrong. We see where that leads in human history, in American history, and world history, and it can't be an acceptable form of discourse. So it looks like that right now they're wrestling with that tendency. It's tough because if they do come out and call a racist and get serious about that issue, it means they're going to have a fundamentally antagonistic relationship to the Trump administration and probably to the Republican Party. And it's going to put them in a position they're extremely loath to be in. They're very controversial. They don't enjoy the hot seat like that. So I think the tendency is to do what you're seeing, which is to try to just sort of play along with it as much as possible and not make, draw attention to it as much as possible, the compromises they're making with racism.
How do you think the media should cover this? NPR had a headline, "Energized by Trump's Win, White Nationalists Gather to Change the World." This was about a conference that was held recently in Washington, D.C., attended by about 300 people. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that white nationalism and white racism and militant white supremacy advocates, I mean, I think there's reasons to cover it, but I think it should be covered very critically. I think it also, there should be put context in these debates of why these are serious issues besides how offensive racism is to, I hope, most people, how deeply pulling, but the consequences of racism for real human lives in this country and around the world. It's not just sort of a debating point at the Oxford Debating Club. We're talking about a history of lynchings, beating, segregation, going back to slavery, and you know, murder. So I think it can't be treated in a neutral, antiseptic form like it's a couple of people at the Tea Club debating whether to have a stop sign at the corner. And so, unfortunately, our professional journalism is not comfortable with that approach to covering the news. That simply goes outside its modus operandi. It's asking it to do something it's not really capable of doing.
And I feel like if they have these people on, shouldn't they always ask about these hate crimes and hate attacks that are happening across the country? And the New York Times had a piece on the 11th, reports of bias-based attacks tick upward after the election. In New York, men shouted, "You're next," at a black policewoman, making shooting motions with their hands. In California, a high school student told a classmate, "You support Trump, you hate Mexicans," before throwing her on the ground and hitting her. Online, anonymous users wrote on Twitter, "Expect a van at your door tomorrow." I mean, this is just, all you have to do is search on Google, and so many things are happening. It's happening in Berkeley, in San Francisco. I've been reading about things happening, like, you know, a Latina woman walking down the street and someone shouting something racist toward her.
Yeah, and I think one thing the news media needs to do is the point you made, Rose, which is I think it's imperative that news media call out all elected officials and politicians to take a stand on this and not let them dance around it and give sort of evasive answers and sort of wink and nod to these movements. And not just Republicans, but I think Democrats too, who I think need to be who need to be forced to take a stronger stand on this across the board and do something about it, to say this is a, you know, we have Americans being threatened now by racism. This is something that's simply not acceptable. And I think they have to be advocates. And I, again, our news media are not comfortable doing that. That's not their comfort zone at all. But you know, that's their function, and they're responsible to no small extent for the situation getting so far out of hand. I mean, and that's where it gets to the earlier point. In the process of there being some soul searching, this has got to be something they've got to be looking at very carefully.
Well, and it's also interesting that they're doing this very deep soul searching. How did we get this so wrong? You know, a lot of these outlets, people based in New York and D.C. are saying, well, maybe we need to leave our bubble and go to the middle of the country. And I'm thinking, well, in D.C. you've got massive poverty. In New York you have massive poverty. In San Francisco we have massive poverty. I mean, you don't need to walk very far probably from your office to find people who are struggling.
Yeah, I mean, one of the lessons of our what's left of our news media, and we should really talk at some point about how, in fact, we don't have much news media, so we're making a mountain out of a molehill here. But what's left of our news media, largely this punditocracy and a handful of newsrooms on the coast, what's left of them really do, are they're completely missing the boat on what's happening in this country. That's why, you know, what was striking when the going back to the primaries, because that's where the bone is buried for this whole story. Going back to the primaries, they were sitting on this Bernie Sanders story, which whatever one thinks of Bernie Sanders was the most extraordinary political story of our lifetimes, where he's drawing these unbelievable crowds with almost no notice and no media coverage whatsoever. While Hillary Clinton's barely can draw a few hundred people to any event she's holding right up till the very end of the campaign. And it was an uncovered story. Our news media had absolutely no interest. They were just content with the idea that Hillary Clinton was the slam dunk winner of the nomination. Sanders didn't have a chance. That was how all stories were framed. And then once she got the nomination, she was the slam dunk winner of the presidency because no one's going to vote that idiot Trump, who's such a weirdo. And they were completely missed the boat on the first story, which made the second story possible, and then I won't say inevitable, but all too likely as a result of their missing the coverage that needed to be done.
And the other question is, let's say Hillary Clinton did win the Electoral College vote by, you know, 20-30. I mean, it's very close. She's up by about 2 million in the popular vote. And according to reports, if she would have gotten about 50,000 more votes in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin, she would have won the Electoral College. And I keep wondering, would these journalists be asking themselves the same questions, or would they be patting themselves on the back and go about business as usual?
They would, but the difference would be the Republicans would be raising holy hell positions in reverse. And the biggest story in the country today about whether the Electoral College needed to be dumped, if there was a Republican who was the victim and not the champion of this grotesquely undemocratic system. You know, the other issue that's being lost that's related, again, race plays such a large role in this. The Electoral College was created to protect slavery and white supremacy. That's the system that made Trump our president. But the other great issue is that in a state like Wisconsin, and to a lesser extent Michigan and Pennsylvania, but really Wisconsin clearly, the Republican-dominated government here under Scott Walker, which controlled both branches of the state legislature, instituted these voter suppression techniques, completely unjustified. The Brennan Center studied it, so there's no grounds for them. But the clear purpose of reducing the African-American vote turnout, the vote turnout of students and young people, voters who were considered insufficiently likely to vote Republican. And it worked. I mean, there you had to have a voter ID, and you had to establish it with photo ID. So people without driver's licenses had to go find a place to get photo ID, official state ID, which they could day off from work, and oftentimes it wasn't even close by. So you have, you know, lots of people who couldn't vote who used to vote. Mm. And the numbers in Wisconsin, I haven't seen the final figures, but were far more than the difference between what Trump beat Clinton with in the state of Wisconsin. That alone won the state of Wisconsin. These explicitly racist voter suppression acts that Republicans put in place. No, they're the only people who do it, are these Republicans, and they do it clearly to minimize Democratic votes. That's the only way they can win elections in states like Wisconsin. That should be a national scandal. Hmm. That should be a headline story every day about how outrageous that is. You know, if some country like Venezuela got elected with our electoral college and with voter suppression like this, and elected governments that the United States didn't like, it would be grounds for invading the country. Hmm. Yet here it's going on in this country, and it's barely even looked at. I mean, few Americans understand these voter suppression laws that are now routine in states that Republicans control, that are explicitly about minimizing the ability of poor people and people of color to vote.
The nation's Ari Berman has done excellent work on this.
Absolutely.
His book, Give Us the Ballot, excellent. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about voter suppression under Trump. Why, quickly, Robert, and then we're going to go to break, why don't you think the Democrats spend more time talking about voter suppression?
Again, I mean, part of it is that they're cowards, and they are cowards. There's no other word to put it. They just, you know, it's hard to really, you know, respect them for that. But a part of it is the nature of the party. It is not a working class fighting party. It has evolved, as Tom Frank has written elegantly, into really a party of Wall Street and the Pentagon and the mainstream. And that was Hillary Clinton's comfort zone. She was spent the campaign thinking about how to woo Republican voters, how to woo suburban women in Philadelphia to come to vote for her who would normally vote Republican. She wasn't spending the campaign saying, how am I going to fight for working class people whose, you know, the countryside has been devastated, and what can I do to really help restore a standard of living and build a future for the vast majority of Americans who are on the outside. That wasn't in their comfort zone, and so they don't think like that. It's one of the great problems of the Democratic Party, and one of the reasons why, even though demographically it should easily win all national elections almost at landslide proportions, it somehow lost in 2016, which frankly would have seemed utterly impossible to any Republican, let alone Donald Trump.
Well, according to reports, even he was shocked. On today's special edition of Your Calls Media Roundtable, we're speaking with Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Robert is a media scholar and author of several books, including People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, our lines are full, but when somebody drops away, you can call us at 866-798-8255. Toll free, 866-798-8255. When one caller goes away, there'll be room for you. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can tweet us at yourcallradio. Thank you, Elaine and Carrie James of Mill Valley, for being supporters of KLW and part of the many thousands of us who support this station and keeping the local and public and local public radio. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will continue our coverage of the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance movement. Militarized police forces continue to attack water protectors with rubber bullets, tear gas, sound cannons, and on Sunday, cold water in very freezing temperatures. The Obama administration has tried to delay the project. Pipeline construction continues. So does the resistance. We will talk about this on Monday, and I have a piece coming out in 48 Hills, I think in about a half hour, .org, or 48hills.org, about some of the people who've never been involved in activism before, who are putting their lives really on the line, on the front line at Standing Rock. So I hope you can check that out. Today, it's a special edition of Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we're spending the hour with media scholar Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and author of several books. His most recent is really important, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. He co-authored it with the nation's John Nichols. You can search for that show. We had John on earlier this year at yourcallradio.org. Bob is also co-founder of the media reform organization Free Press. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Let me turn you down. This show is just spinning my head around with all the insights of I guess he's Dr. McChesney. He's just brilliant. If you ever resign from our show, Rose, I hope that he will take over. But of course, I hope you never do resign. And my comment was about voters, about some irregularities in the primaries between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And there were many discrepancies in exit polls and things. It kind of seemed like some machines were flipped. and I'm wondering if that might be the reason that Hillary Clinton is not the one who is making the challenge for a recount.
Bob, were you able to hear Judy?
I did. It was a great question. And I don't know the answer to the second part of the question first. I don't know if the irregularities in the primary race give Hillary pause about questioning the general election for fear that people go back and look at the primaries. I don't think she necessarily would think that far backwards or ahead. I do think, though, that Judy's absolutely right. There were a lot of irregularities with the primary races, and part of it is that the caucus races that were held in the Democratic and Republican parties are not run by the government. They're not publicly. They're run by the party itself. So in Iowa, Nevada, and other states that hold caucuses, where you have the party, which basically is in the hip pocket of Hillary Clinton, we now know. We knew then, but we now especially know. They bent every possible rule they could to guarantee somehow Hillary Clinton came out with a win. And we know that in cases like Iowa and Nevada, where she won narrow victories but claimed huge victories and got the press coverage as if she'd won huge victories, that there are grounds to believe that those were very dubious victories, if we could ever track down the truth of it. But there was a lot of shenanigans going on in both those states, as well as other states, that question, you know, the veracity. And, I mean, I think that these are issues. The fact that we're having this sort of conversation, Rose, the fact that people are questioning the integrity of the systems by which we select president at this sort of fundamental level, there are grounds for these concerns. That alone should be enough to be a national scandal or a national crisis, that we even can countenance this sort of situation. Yet I think it's without a doubt a situation to face where we can't really trust, in fact, the nature of our elections to accurately reflect what our people want.
Yeah, well, we're definitely going to do a show about this. The Electronic Frontier Foundation put out an article today called E-Voting Machines Need Paper Audits to Be Trustworthy. They're pointing to a number of articles by security experts who are calling for an audit of the ballots in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. California decertified many voting machines due to serious security flaws back in 2004, and in many states across the country, those same machines are still being used. When we had on Kim Alexander from the California Voter Foundation, she said, "I have so much faith in California's system, I don't have faith in some other states because they're using these machines that have some flaws that need to be dealt with."
Yeah, absolutely. This is an existential issue. Part of it, there's a lot of different levels to this. It starts and begins with things like electoral college and voter suppression and goes right down to the nature of machines and how they're counted. But all these things together point in one direction, ultimately, that the United States has to join the 19th and 20th century, not the midst of the 21st century. We just got to have a right to vote in our Constitution, and the right to vote has to be that each vote is equal, one person, one vote. So by that, we get rid of the Electoral College, we get rid of gerrymandering, we get rid of voter suppression. We basically is committed to a society in which every adult can vote, period, and there are no like ways you can suppress the vote. And that's really, until we do that, we're going to constantly open to all this sort of chicanery. And the problem with this isn't just that the bad guys or people who don't deserve to win elections, even if you like them, win elections and take power. The problem is, I think when you're in a situation where the electoral system loses its credibility, it opens the door to situations like we're in now, where we have a minority government that's in power, that a lot of Americans don't take seriously because it didn't win a majority of the votes. In fact, it now looks like, as you pointed out, lost by more than 2 million votes. And my talking to experts, they tell me that figure could go as high as 2.5 million. And that doesn't even factor in voter suppression. That doesn't factor in screwed-up machines someplace, too. When you have a minority government that's extraordinarily controversial, with white supremacists running around, it's really like playing with dynamite for society. This is not an issue that can be swept under the rug at this point.
Well, and then add into that that so many Americans are angry with the media. They don't trust the media. I mean, I'm getting a lot of more complaints than ever over the last 2 weeks about media coverage of this election.
You know, and on that issue, we should point out, because you made this in your opening of the show, but we have to return this. It's easy to forget. We don't have hardly any political journalism left in this country. And I think because of the plethora of 24-hour news channels on TV, because of all the internet stuff you get in the news, if you click on a story or put a politician's name in and thousands of stories come up, we forget the fact that there's actually very few original reporters who are covering politics in a serious manner, or even in a frivolous manner, who are getting paid to do so. You know, most of the races that people vote for on the ballot, aside from president and maybe a couple of statewide races like senator or governor, get virtually no coverage in our news media. So you're really just voting for party or for surname or what a neighbor might have told you. You're just guessing when you vote for most positions on the ballot. There's no news coverage to speak of. And when you're voting for president, we know what you're voting for. You're voting for TV ads. You're voting for nonsense. There's not really any journalism in what's being done at CNN or MSNBC or Fox. They're basically this celebrity millionaire blowhard spinning you with one party's talking points or the other party's talking points. And then they have their guests on. Their guests are just, you know, partisan hacks for the most part, or journalists who want to be partisan hacks spewing out talking points. And, you know, but it's, there's no educational or nutritional value to it at all. It's just complete time wasting. You could have that sort of journalism coverage that we get of our elections. You know, you could have had that in China covering central committee elections to the Politburo or something, because there's really no content to them. They're nutritionless.
And again, we should point out that according to the Washington Post, CNN will break profits this year by bringing in $1 billion. At the same time, CNN's president Jeff Zucker said CNN probably should have not aired so many unedited Trump rallies. And then you have Fox bringing in about $1.6 billion, MSNBC around $400 million. And so I think this is such a good point, Robert. I like to make a distinction between cable shows and the rest, but a lot of these talking heads are multimillionaires, and the pundits also make a lot of money. Thomas Frank, in his last Harper's piece, said, you know, these people, they go to the same restaurants, they're married to politicians, they're not going to have to rely on Social Security or Medicare. Maybe once these pundits lose their jobs, they will be in favor of universal health care and Medicare, but by then it's going to be too late.
Yeah, and Tom is absolutely right. I think these companies make so much money, CNN and Fox News, these the subsidiaries of larger conglomerates, they make so much money because their costs are so low. They draw in lots of advertising revenue, but they don't have any reporters. They don't have a newsroom. It's not like MSNBC's got a fleet of reporters breaking stories all the time, or CNN, or Fox News. Basically what they do is, if they want to actually cover a story that's journalism, they might get a reporter from the Washington Post to come in and talk about their report, or the Wall Street Journal, but they don't break any stories themselves. They're just basically advertising sales departments and celebrity blowhards and bookers, people who book these guests to come on. There's not really any journalism being done at all. And that's just not much journalism being done at all. You know, so we have a situation in the presidential race, for example, in which, you know, there's only really a couple of newsrooms that are covering it, the New York Times and the Washington Post. And the Washington Post is, we now know, completely in the tank for Hillary Clinton from day one. And, you know, there's missing stories right and left. There's just a lot of stuff not being covered whatsoever. And it's a source of endless frustration. I think the American people are absolutely correct to be frustrated, because what we're getting is simply not of much value for helping us deal with the great issues that our government needs to be dealing with.
And I want to get my numbers right. MSNBC is expected to grow 19% to almost $300 million this year. Before we get back to calls, Robert, what about these fantastic nonprofit news and organizations like ProPublica? I mean, they do fantastic reporting, but outside of journalism circles, their stories don't get shared on Facebook like the sort of Trump headline I see on a regular basis.
Yeah, and I mean, there are these groups like ProPublica. There's a handful of others. There's lots of people trying to do work who depend upon foundation grants and philanthropy. Because the great problem we have in the United States today is the commercial model of journalism is dead. Companies can't make money hiring lots of reporters and then producing the product and hoping that advertisers will support it sufficiently. And that's regrettably more true online than anywhere else. So the only people making money are these TV networks with their celebrity blowhards and a handful of newspapers that have monopoly markets. Online journalism is a commercial dead end. And it's only going to get worse. And that's the true story here. The 2016 election was really the first almost entirely journalism-free election, on which there was just no journalism. So that doesn't mean there aren't people doing their best to do great work on the margins, but it basically stays on the margins as fair, and it's not getting cultivated, encouraged. It's not part of the dialogue of the country to anywhere sufficient extent. And I think the other moral of the story is that there's just not enough resources to support a ProPublica. We can't expect philanthropists to pay for our journalism, even though we expect philanthropists to pay for our national defense.
Today we're speaking with Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, author of many books, including his most recent, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. It's an excellent book that looks at the realities of automation. What happens when so many jobs get automated? When we did a show about this, we talked about the seriousness of a universal basic income, which doesn't get much attention in the national media, but we really need to start talking about this. You can find that show with his co-author, John Nichols, at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Good morning, Rose and Robert. Thank you for an excellent show. I have a quick comment on the electoral issue. And that is that my math leads me to believe that even if Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania turn for Hillary, she still loses in the Electoral College vote by 270 to 268. So would somebody please check that out? My main comment, the reason for my call, is that I think it should be emphasized more that the reason that Donald Trump won was because the American people, or a great percentage of the American people, are very upset with our government. He overcame a huge financial disadvantage in the money being spent in the election. He overcame a huge bias by the press and the media in favor of Hillary Clinton, and he won because, I think, people are really upset with the way our government is working. So my question is, why cannot the Democrats/progressives put forward a candidate who has a more populist outlook? And I do not mean to disparage Mr. Sanders, but he is a 76-year-old socialist, and I think we should be able to do better than that.
Well, thank you. You know, I think it's important to point out that Donald Trump didn't need to spend money because the media gave him coverage that most candidates like Hillary Clinton spend hundreds of millions to get. Bob, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a great question that Don makes. I would just disagree with his assessment of Sanders. Maybe for looking at the future, Sanders himself is not a viable choice because of his age or because he's a socialist. But I would say the lesson of 2016 was that this country was very much ready for Sanders, and all the polling that I've seen suggests that Sanders would have won a race with Trump and probably won it going away. I do a lot of traveling and meeting with young people because I had the book tour this year. I was on a lot of college campuses, and I do a lot of talks to begin with. And I was teaching this fall as well at Illinois, and one thing that's just absolutely striking was that Bernie Sanders is drawing support among people under 30 that was, as far as I can tell, unprecedented in American history, not just in the Democratic Party or any party, but as nationally. And even he supported people under 40. It was quite extraordinary. The young people of this country, the people, the millennials, are not right wingers. They're not white supremacists. That's not where this is coming from. And they're progressive, and they really responded well to Sanders's message in extraordinary ways. And I saw this when I was on the trail with Sanders a couple times and saw his events, the enthusiasm, which is so extraordinary, and also saw many of Sanders' stump speeches, which were very policy-heavy. Donald Trump's speech is all an exercise in narcissism, him talking about his views of the world and talking about his career and his money and everything. Sanders' talks were basically go through like 30 different policies and really educating people and drawing them in on how important these issues are. And it worked. I mean, it was really unprecedented in my lifetime, and I'm 63 years old, to see something like this. So I would say that I think Sanders would have won the election had he had a chance to win the nomination, and I think he would have won going away. I think that the idea that saying you're a democratic socialist will hurt you, the polling shows that's simply not the case. They thought that red-baiting him as being some fan of the Soviet Union, which he wasn't, would derail his case, so that no effect whatsoever. It just doesn't work. And lastly, what I would say about that in terms of Sanders, what was most striking was this fall, when the race was Clinton versus Trump, and I talked to a lot of young people, a lot of college students, and working class young people who aren't in college, and there was almost no enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton. There were a handful of people who liked her, were enthusiastic. I won't say none, but very, very little. It was, you wouldn't even know there's a presidential race going on. No one liked Trump. No one. Wow. But there were not many people who cared much for Hillary Clinton. There were a lot of people who were really pissed off at Hillary Clinton. But there was just no enthusiasm for this race. It was just a wet blanket race. You wouldn't even know there was a race compared to the primary season when the college campuses were just bursting with energy. I mean, it was night and day difference. I think until there's some evidence to the contrary, I think that the idea that Bernie Sanders wouldn't have been able to win the election in this fall is simply, there's no grounds for that. I think he would have won going away. He would have, all those people who would have worked their butts off for Bernie sat it out. They might have voted for Hillary, but they weren't leafleting like lunatics for her in the fall. They would have been leafleting like lunatics for Sanders, and I think that would have been more than enough to win all the states in the upper Midwest that Hillary lost, as well as some others.
Well, thank you for that call. Let's go next to Chris. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I get into discussions, and I got into them during the primary season, about the corporate media tilting or rigging the election for Hillary Clinton. And most people deny it. They still deny it. Even after the general election, they deny it. So I wonder, because he knows a lot more than I do, if Mr. McChesney could list a couple pieces of evidence of ways that they handed the Democratic nomination to Senator Clinton or Secretary Clinton.
Yeah, I can give a little bit on that. There's going to be a lot more coming out because I think this issue is going to be mined well with the WikiLeaks revelations to show the collaboration between the Clinton campaign, the DNC, and the major news media during the whole primary period. But I can give you, and so a lot of stuff, I'll give you one classic example right now of how that whole thing played out. I mean, one of the things I discovered during the campaign, a primary campaign, was I would talk to lots of friends of mine who were completely sympathetic to Sanders, but they would say, well, he has no chance of getting the nomination because Hillary's more popular and the superdelegates, and it's just not worth doing it. So we have to support Hillary since she's the only one that could possibly beat a Republican. Sanders couldn't possibly win because he's a socialist. And these were sort of memes that they were constantly hearing at CNN and MSNBC and in the Washington Post, that these are just taken for granted. It's like it's part of the air that, of course, Sanders could never win a general, and Hillary, of course, is going to definitely win the primary because she was so much more popular, ultimately, with Democratic voters. And they framed everything this way, and that framing had a tremendous effect because they barely, the two ways you could look at the way the coverage was slanted against Sanders. One was just the lack of coverage. During that second half of 2015, when Sanders is developing this enormous following and he's jumping up in the polls, where he's tied in Iowa and ahead of New Hampshire by the end of the year, where Hillary and Sanders are both campaigning actively, and where he's drawing these enormous crowds, he's hardly getting any coverage whatsoever, even on the liberal MSNBC. They barely talk about him while they're flooding the airwaves with coverage of Trump. Here is MSNBC has not a single Trump voter watching it, yet they're covering Trump around the clock, and they don't even mention Sanders is running. He's not taken seriously. And that has an effect. I mean, people turn on the news and they're just not even seeing him. They say, well, maybe it's just weird. You know, I don't get it. Maybe he's not a serious candidate. And the other thing I'd say is that I live in Wisconsin, and in Wisconsin, there's a primary is always held in the middle of the primary season. And since 1960, the Wisconsin primary has been the single most important primary in the Democratic Party. The winner of this primary always wins the nomination and usually wins the presidency. It is an extraordinary race because it's always at the end of March or early April, and by then it's usually down to two candidates, and it's close, and whoever wins Wisconsin goes on to take the nomination. And I don't think a Democrat's been elected president since John F. Kennedy in 1960, including John F. Kennedy in 1960, unless they won Wisconsin. And it doesn't always go for the liberal. It went for Jimmy Carter, for example. It doesn't always pick the liberal choice. It went for John Kerry over John Edwards. It took Dukakis over Jesse Jackson. So when Bernie Sanders won Wisconsin by a blowout victory over Hillary Clinton and the Democratic machine in the state of Wisconsin by 18 points, I think it was, a 58-40 routing, just clobbered her. That should have been a night on the news media, MSNBC, CNN, where they're just saying, wow, this is really history-making. Bernie Sanders just crushed her in a state that she, by all rights, by historical record, I mean, she's out. She doesn't have a prayer. He's going to win the nomination. We should take this guy seriously. He's now the favorite. And instead, I remember well, because I was following this closely on this very issue, the coverage that night was nothing of the kind. The entire coverage was, well, Bernie Sanders gave an interview with the New York Daily News where it looks like he fumbled a question, and now he's going to be grilled about whether he knows what he's talking about. And that turned out to be a completely fraudulent story, but the Clinton campaign had sent that out that night, knowing they were going to lose Wisconsin. And the entire talking heads that night and next morning were about Bernie's flubbed interview with the Daily News. Nothing about the historic importance of his demolishing her in Wisconsin in a blowout victory, where it was just one person against one person for a full week. There were no other races to be run. So the whole country was looking at this one race. And that was, I think now the WikiLeaks or so, that was the Clinton campaign had their friends in the news media frame it exactly the way the Clinton campaign wanted it to be framed. So Wisconsin played no role whatsoever in changing the coverage.
Well, we will continue following all of these angles in the coming months. Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and co-author of People Get Ready. Bob, thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure, Rose. Love to be back anytime you want me.
Great. Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance movement. Militarized police forces continue to attack water protectors with tear gas, beanbag rounds, rubber bullets, sound cannons, and cold water and freezing temperatures. The Obama administration has tried to delay the project, but pipeline construction continues. So does the resistance. So what's next? Email your questions and comments to feedback@yourcallradio.org and join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Marco Chacon wrote fake news stories to amuse his friends and to satirize the election. But then, fragments of his stories get picked up by conspiracy theorists, fake news sites, and eventually even mainstream media. Stories he concocted to be outrageous ended up being stuff people believed. Marco joins us to explain why his stories went super viral this week on Day 6.
Later today at 6 o'clock for Day 6 from the CBC here on 91.7 KLW.
Kelly Zekin is an unwitting welfare recipient. She comes from an upper middle class family, but the state of Michigan is helping her out with tuition using welfare dollars.
Free money, I guess, is kind of the running joke in our house, but you know, I didn't know exactly what qualified me for it.
We take a welfare reform road trip with Marketplace on the next Reveal.
11 o'clock here on KLW San Francisco.
People in the United States are more likely to suffer from an anxiety disorder, a clinical anxiety disorder, than anyone anywhere else in the world.
I'm Lauren Schiller. Every week on Inflection Point, I talk with women who are changing the status quo. That was Ruth Whitman. She's the author of America the Anxious, How Our Pursuit of Happiness is Making Us a Nation of Nervous Wrecks. Sound familiar?
One of the most important things I've learned in my life, how to just keep your heart open to everybody.
That's Donna Jaffe, the president of Peaceable Kingdom, a cooperative board game company for kids. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point. We'll be back right after this.